So let's again start with a short meditation. Finding a nice, comfortable posture. And letting go of any external distractions. Bring your awareness into your own body. Becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. And use the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. So that the entire body becomes completely relaxed, completely at ease. And allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Allowing it to flow naturally, effortlessly. Not trying to control it in any way. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen. Letting go of any thoughts of the past or the future. In particular, letting go of any expectations for this meditation. simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Through focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body, and then narrow the focus and focus on the sensations of the breath at the entrance of your nostrils. And use the rope of mindfulness to tie your mind to the sensations of the breath at the nostrils. And use the hook of introspection to monitor that, so that if you notice you're becoming distracted, then simply relax, release the distraction, and return to focusing on the breath. Or if you notice that you're becoming dull or spaced out, then sharpen your focus on the sensations of the breath. I am sitting here meditating, trying to focus my mind on the breath. How does this me who is meditating appear to exist? Does this me who is here appear to exist from its own side? Not seeming to depend upon anything else to exist. Does it seem to be self-existent? Now, can we point to something as being this me, the me who is here meditating? The me who is here meditating, of course, has two arms and two legs. These are things which we possess. Which means we are not the arms and legs. You can't possess something and also be it at the same time. So we are not our arms and legs. We also have a torso. Which means we are not our torso. We also have a head, which means we are not the head. We also have a brain, which means we are not the brain. And we have a body, which means me, the meditator, is not the body. We have thoughts, so therefore we are not our thoughts. We have emotions. So we are not our emotions. We have concepts. So we are not our concepts. We have memories. So we are not our memories. We have a personality. So we are not our personality. And we have a mind. So me, the meditator, is not the mind. We are not our mind. we have a body and a mind. So we are not our body and mind. These are all things which we have, things which we possess. But where is the me that possesses all these things? Apart from the body and the mind, what else is there here? If there's nothing more than the body and the mind here, where is the me who possesses this body and this mind? Now, even if you didn't find the me, Isn't there someone who's experiencing this not finding? So there is a me here, sitting here, doing this meditation. But just because we don't seem to be able to find it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. It simply means it's empty of findable, independent existence. That doesn't mean there's no me at all. The me that is meditating here is the dependent me. A me depending on the body and the mind. A me that is merely labeled on the basis of the body that is sitting here and the mind that is trying to focus on the breath. The merely labeled me is sitting here meditating. And then release all appearances and simply allow the mind to come to rest. Resting in the present moment. Resting in awareness itself. Without really trying to do anything at all, without even trying to meditate, just rest. Resting in luminously clear awareness. Open and spacious. So again, let's start our discussions by first reading through the Heart Sutra together. The heart of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. Thus did I hear at one time. The Bhagavan was dwelling on Massive Vultures Mountain in Rajgir, together with a great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. At that time, the Bhagavan was absorbed in the concentration on the categories of phenomena called profound perception. Also at that time, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara looked upon the very practice of the profound perfection of wisdom and beheld those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Then, through the power of Buddha, the Venerable Shariputra said this to the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara: "How should any son of the lineage train who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom?" He said that, and the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Aryavalokiteshvara said this to the Venerable Sharadvatriputra: "Shariputra, any son of the lineage or daughter of the lineage who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom should look upon it like this, correctly and repeatedly beholding those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Form is empty. Emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form. Form is also not other than emptiness. In the same way, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors and consciousness are empty. Shariputra, likewise all phenomena are emptiness. Without characteristic, unproduced, unceased, stainless, not without stain, not deficient, not fulfilled. Shariputra, therefore, in emptiness there is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no compositional factors, no consciousness. No eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. No visual form, no sound, no odor, no taste, no object of touch, and no phenomenon. There is no eye element, and so on, up to and including no mind element, and no mental consciousness element. There is no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance, and so on, up to and including no aging and death, and no extinction of aging and death. Similarly, there is no suffering, origination, cessation, and path. There is no exalted wisdom, no attainment, and also no non-attainment. Shariputra, therefore, because there is no attainment, bodhisattvas rely on and dwell in the perfection of wisdom, the mind without obscuration and without fear. Having completely passed beyond error, they reach the end point of nirvana. All the Buddhas who dwell in the three times also manifestly completely awaken to unsurpassable, perfect, complete enlightenment in reliance on the perfection of wisdom. Therefore, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom, the mantra of great knowledge, the unsurpassed mantra, the mantra equal to the unequaled, the mantra that thoroughly pacifies all suffering, should be known as truth, since it is not false. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom is declared: Tayata Om Gati Gati Paragati Parasamgati Bodhisvaha. Shariputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, should train in the profound perfection of wisdom like that. Then the Bhagavan arose from that concentration and commended the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Aryavalokiteshvara, saying, well said, son of the lineage, it is like that. It is like that. One should practice the profound perfection of wisdom just as you have indicated. Even the Tathagatas rejoice. The Bhagavan having thus spoken, the Venerable Sharadvatriputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Aryavalokiteshvara, those surrounding in their entirety along with the world of gods, humans, asuras and gandhavas were overjoyed and highly praised that spoken by the Bhagavan. So again, let's do a short review, particularly of the things we covered yesterday, before we move on in our discussions today. So in the Heart Sutra here, we are in the first part of the answer that Avalokiteshvara is giving to Shariputra, meaning how to practice this wisdom of emptiness on the first two stages of the Mahayana path to enlightenment, that is the path of accumulation and the path of preparation. And in the brief answer, we saw that Avalokiteshvara was saying that we are to subsequently see in a correct way that those five aggregates are also empty of inherent nature, meaning to subsequent to logical investigation, we are to come to realize this, meaning that when we first develop or cultivate this wisdom of emptiness, then emptiness is not something that we can directly perceive with our senses. It's not what's called a manifest phenomenon, which means that we need to first come to understand it and experience it through logical reasoning, through inference, to come to subsequently see that things are empty of independent existence based on this very logical approach. Now, of course, here, on the first two stages of the spiritual path, we have a very stable, clear mind already developed. We have the mind of shamatha. So when we come to do this investigation and come to see that not just the person, but the basis of the person, the body and the mind, are empty of inherent nature, then we will have what's called an inferential or conceptual realization. So remember, we go through these three stages. Go nyam tok. So remember, go was intellectual understanding. So of course, first we have to hear about this view. We have to think about it. We have to develop a intellectual understanding of this as a framework for our practice. And then, of course, we apply that in our practice. We meditate, we investigate the nature of reality in this very methodical way, and then we can come to have some little taste or experience of emptiness, which was this nyam. And this taste or experience, of course, of emptiness, may have quite a strong impact on our mind, meaning it may still affect our mind after the meditation for some time, some minutes, hours, or even days. And during that time, of course, that experience of emptiness will be strong enough to reduce our grasping a lot, because emptiness, of course, that understanding and realization is opposite to the ignorance. So you will find that during that time that the grasping onto me and grasping onto independent world will be very much reduced, which means that there'll be much less mental afflictions coming up, weaker, more peaceful, we'll feel more connected also with others and the world. But this will wear off, of course, as our habits reassert themselves. So, of course, to move forward, we need to then work on stabilizing the mind so that this experience becomes an actual realization which has a more lasting effect. And of course, for that to happen, we need to work on our shamatha practice. So we had a look at that earlier in the course. So here, of course, the brief instruction again was saying that those five aggregates also, meaning not just the person, but the body and the mind, are also empty of inherent nature, which is sort of indicating to us the order in which we are to investigate the various things that exist. That it's first recommended that we investigate ourselves as a person and to see whether there is in fact this independent me here or not. Because this is where the whole process starts to go wrong, grasping onto this me and thereby grasping onto everything as independent of this independent me. Whereas when you look in the texts, and also here in this text, usually when they start to describe the process of how to do this, they would use a physical object, and generally when we look at this emptiness practice in the Tibetan tradition, often using as a basis the text from Chandrakirti, a great Indian master, and he uses the example of a chariot, dissecting the chariot in what's called the sevenfold reasoning to see where is this chariot that really seems to be there. But of course, when we come to meditate, then we begin with person. And so we had a little bit of a look at how to do that yesterday. But before I review that a little bit, then the first statement that we're looking at yesterday was this form is empty. And again, when we see this, then we need to ask, empty of what? Empty of inherent existence or independent existence. So this is, of course, emptiness. So emptiness is not really saying nothing exists. Emptiness is saying that nothing exists independently. Even though it appears as if there is an independent me here and an independent objective world out there, this view here is saying that these appearances are deceiving us. Things are not existing in the way they appear to us. And then we went on to see why believing these appearances is actually the root of all of our suffering. So we had a look at that suffering and its causes chart. And so we saw there that at the first stage, the first step of the process, we have this seed of ignorance, which is the habit of believing that there's an independent me, an independent world there, and that in every one of our experiences, things really do appear to exist independent of us, which here is called mistaken dualistic appearance. And of course, things have always appeared to us in this way, so we never question these appearances, we just accept them. And that leads to step two of ignorance, of simply grasping onto, yes, there's independent me here, independent world there. And then based on that grasping, then of course in every one of our experiences, we have this mental factor of feeling, meaning that we experience things as either being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And when we have those pleasant, unpleasant, neutral experiences, together with this grasping, this ignorance, then, of course, if we have a pleasant experience, we will naturally assume there must be some attractive quality in the object that is causing my pleasant feeling. Therefore, we will see these things as inherently attractive. Or if I'm having an unpleasant feeling, we'll see them as inherently unattractive, which is the third step, this misconception. And then, based on seeing things as either inherently attractive or unattractive, based on our pleasant, unpleasant feelings, then of course, pleasant feelings is something I like, I want. That object seems to be causing my pleasant feeling, I want that object. Attachment. Or of course, if we have unpleasant feeling, we don't like those things, that object seems to be causing my unpleasant feeling, get it out of here. Aversion. And these attachment aversion leads to all of our other mental afflictions such as jealousy and anxiety and fear and all these. And these mental afflictions are what's driving our behavior. And then our behavior, of course, ends up in, as a result of our behavior, we have the various experiences which the Buddha described using the word dukkha. So this is how this grasping onto this independent me, independent world, really is the source of dukkha, the root of samsara. So what we saw there was that if we really want to overcome this unsatisfactory state, if we want to get out of samsara, this cycle of existence. We need to eliminate this ignorance. We need to come to realize there is no independent me, no independent objective world, meaning we need to come to realize emptiness. But then, of course, we saw there was something else, is that this ignorance also has another side effect, in that the ignorance stains our mind with this what's called latency of ignorance. And that stain of ignorance is what is actually causing things to appear to be exist independent of us. And so these stains are what is stopping us from achieving enlightenment. So we have to eliminate these stains which cause this mistaken dualistic appearance. These stains are very subtle, very difficult to get rid of. And these stains are what's called these cognitive obscurations. And so we're going to be looking at that later in the Heart Sutra when we come to the section on the path of meditation, where we will see how we slowly get rid of these afflictive obscurations, meaning the ignorance and mental afflictions, and then how we go about eliminating these subtle stains in our mind to finally achieve enlightenment. Then what we also did yesterday was briefly looked at that six steps again in a more practical way in terms of short-term practical advice, because from that we saw that the long-term strategy is that we really need to develop this wisdom of emptiness. The short-term strategy of how at least to reduce the impact of this process, we looked at the various stages of that process, and we saw that one of the main things that we can do is to develop mindfulness. That through our shamatha practice, we are of course strengthening our mindfulness, our ability to focus. And then of course we can actively cultivate mindfulness in daily life. And if we can really strengthen our mindfulness, then that's going to be very helpful at a number of the steps in this process. At the early step of having the pleasant, unpleasant experiences, then with mindfulness, instead of reacting to those pleasant and unpleasant experiences, we can simply observe the pleasant and unpleasant feelings and sensations as they arise within the body and the mind and not react to them. And that is a very effective way or point to cut the process. This is very much emphasized in many Buddhist traditions, particularly many of the Theravada traditions put a lot of emphasis at that point. And then, of course, also with mindfulness, at the next step, when things start to look so attractive and so unattractive to us, then with mindfulness, again, instead of reacting to that, we can look at those objects or people that look so attractive and so unattractive and try to find the attractiveness or unattractiveness in the object. And through doing that, we'll come to realize and see there is no attractiveness or unattractiveness in the object itself from its own side. That we are interpreting that person or thing as being either attractive or unattractive, meaning that beauty or ugliness is in the eye of the beholder. And in that way, by seeing that, that can stop attachment and aversion. Or if we are starting to get some attachment or aversion coming up in our mind, or any mental affliction coming up in our mind, then with mindfulness, we can catch that when it first starts to arise. Because normally now we don't have very good mindfulness, which means when some mental affliction arises, particularly if it's something strong like anger or jealousy, then we get overwhelmed by that and we simply follow it. And then once we're caught up in it, there's not much we can do to work with it because our mind is already out of control. So the trick, of course, is, again, with mindfulness, is to catch the early stages of that. There's that little window of opportunity where we start to notice some irritation or agitation or a little bit of craving coming up. At that point, we're still enough in control of the mind that we can catch that. And then, of course, we can do something and not allow it to overwhelm ourselves. And, of course, there are a number of different things we can do. One is simply observe that. Observe that mental affliction arise. Don't try to get rid of it. Don't get caught up in it. Is simply observe it arise and pass. Arise and pass. And this will become a lot easier to do in daily life if, of course, we are doing the shamatha practice, particularly the practice of observing the mind, because we are in meditation developing that habit already to observe mental events arising and passing. And then we can begin to do that also in daily life. Of course, on top of that, if some mental affliction is arising, we can apply some antidote to it, some direct antidote. If it's attachment, to look at the transient nature of things. If it's jealousy, we instead rejoice. If it's anger, then cultivate loving kindness, compassion instead. So at that stage, then again, mindfulness is very helpful. But also at the last step, where we're actually in the moment experiencing some unpleasant experience, physical or mental, mindfulness here also can be very helpful. Because without mindfulness, if we have some unpleasant experience arising, then we immediately don't want that, and we immediately have aversion to it, wanting or hoping it to go away. And of course that aversion to that unpleasant experience just magnifies our suffering. So if we have mindfulness, again, we can simply notice that unpleasant experience and accept it, meaning, yes, there is an unpleasant experience here. And then follow Shanti Deva's advice. If you can fix it, no need to get upset, just fix it. If you can't fix it, no point in getting upset. And so then we can at least stop the aversion and thereby not magnify the suffering. But again, we can also use that unpleasant experience to help us to develop compassion for others who also may have something similar happening at the moment. So I think in all of those stages in that process, one of the key elements that can really help us to minimize the impact of that process is this mindfulness. So that shamatha practice, not only is it really essential as a basis to make our vipassana practice more effective, but the shamatha practice itself has these direct benefits in our daily life. Then we went on to look at how do we do this logical investigation, you know, how do we come to subsequently see that the person and the body and the mind are empty of inherent nature, or empty of inherent existence. Now, of course, this Heart Sutra here, heart, of course, meaning essence, is very brief in words. So these different types of ways of investigating are not laid out here at all, really. That you will find that the different ways of investigating are laid out in detail in the more extensive Perfection of Wisdom literature. But we briefly looked at five ways of investigating. And what we saw was that the first three were not so easy to use as a beginner, because they involve looking at the object from the perspective of causes and results, which for as at a beginning level is not really that easy to do. It's much easier to look at the thing itself, to investigate the thing itself, which was the fourth approach, the fourth type of reasoning, this same or different. And the fifth one was the reasoning of dependent arising, which we're going to now look at in the next topic. So then we looked at this fourth reasoning, the reasoning of same and different, or same or different, as a way to investigate how things exist. And so when we apply this reasoning to the person, then we have that presentation of the four essential points that we looked at yesterday in the afternoon, is that the first point is to get a clear picture of how we see ourselves existing. How does this me that really seems to be here, how does this me appear to the mind? This, what His Holiness calls identifying the target, or the technical word is identifying the object of negation. This is the most important point in this meditation, and this is the point where a lot of people start to go wrong in their meditation. Because what we need to be looking for is the me that we're grasping onto, the me that we're believing in. And I think the me that we're grasping onto is a me that seems to be really solid, self-existent. It seems to really exist completely independent of everything else. This is the me that we are basing all of our behavior on, and this is the me we need to look for, and not to start to look for some abstract idea of who we think we are, and not to make it some intellectual process, because then we've missed the point. Because again, we're not basing our behavior on our intellectual idea of who we think we are or how we think we exist. We're basing our behavior on our instinctive sense of me. That's the me we need to be looking for. And here then, in those four essential points, is to understand that that me, if it exists, can only exist in one of two places. Either it's something as being the same as the body and the mind, or different than the body and the mind. And then if we search in those two places and we don't find the me cannot exist. And so then we go through that search, looking for the me amongst the body and the mind, or as something separate from the body and the mind. And so we explained that a little bit yesterday, and we had, I think Jonas led a little bit of a meditation based on that, and also in this morning's meditation, that was something very similar, the approach we followed this morning as well. So again, this is something that we need to continually hear about, reflect on, and meditate on. This is not something that's very simple, very easy to do, because it's not something where one is the reason it's not so easy for us. Of course, actually, if you look at the steps are quite straightforward, but to actually follow them well is not easy for us, because one is our mind is not very clear and focused, meaning that we're trying to do this and then we sort of get distracted or get confused or become dull. And secondly, of course, is that even we have this strong grasping onto me, we never really look at this me because we're always focusing outward. So we don't really have a good picture of this me that we're believing in, because we're not focusing on that. We're really focusing on everything else. So that's why I think in the beginning phases it's good to really just slowly get a more and more clear picture of this me that really seems to be here, and to really be patient with ourselves and not to get too frustrated if it doesn't work so well, this process. Again, this is something that takes time to work on, and particularly in terms of developing a more clear, focused, stable mind. You'll find that if you work on that, you'll find this meditation also becomes a lot easier to do because of the concentration and clarity of mind. So that's where we really left off yesterday. So before we move on to the next point, is there any questions about anything that we've covered so far in that form is empty statement? Anyone would like to bring up any questions? Because now I want to go to the second statement, emptiness is form.
It's not about the particular form is empty. I was wondering, like, I was reading a couple of other sutras, basically from Pali Temple, and they were always, first of all, very simple, like, I was reading Anapanasati Sutra.
Yeah, sure.
Like, breathe in long, breathe in short.
Sure.
This one, and all of them were addressed by the Buddha, saying...
They were all what, sorry?
All of them were like taught by Buddha.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, if it's called a sutra, that implies it's a discourse of the Buddha.
But here, we have new characters like Avalokiteshvara, as well as the whole of sutra is taught by Avalokiteshvara. As well, it's very complex. Like, it's very...
Well, I don't know. Some Pali sutras I've read don't sound too simple. They're a bit complex. I look at them, what?
I just read a
book. Sure. Sure, sure.
I wanted to know, is it just the Mahayana sutras are like that, or the Pali sutras also?
No, I think also you find in Pali sutras there's sometimes conversations with disciples, Subhuti and Ananda, and these various people come up in various sutras. I mean, every sutra, of course, is a discourse and involving different people, so I don't think there's any generalization like that.
Here, especially, like, Buddha is taking sort of a backseat.
Sure. Sure, yeah. But I don't think you'll find that that's the case in all the Mahayana sutras. See, the thing is, within the Mahayana traditions, particularly in the Tibetan tradition, it's not that common to directly go into the sutras. Because, again, the Buddha's discourses, he taught according to people's capacity and what their needs were. So, he didn't sort of sit down and say, okay, here's my whole philosophy and go through the whole thing. I mean, to this group he taught this because that's what they needed to hear and help them. So he taught many different things to many different people, many different topics all over the place. And so then if we as a disciple wanted to really get a good understanding of a particular topic, whether it's compassion or selflessness or whatever, we would have to sift through many different sutras, and then often they're not that easy to follow, so it would make our job quite difficult to get a good view of that topic. So fortunately, a lot of the great Indian masters did this work for us. You know, masters like Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti, Shantideva, Buddhapalita, Buddhaghosa, all these great masters did this work for us, and then pulled together on a particular topic, pulled together ideas from different sutras that the Buddha taught, and put them together in a very clear, systematic way. And so then, if we want to look at the Buddha's teachings, Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, instead of poring through all the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, we can go to Nagarjuna's text, we can go to Chandrakirti's text, which is specifically about emptiness, and then we can get a clearer picture based on that. So certainly you'll find, and I think this applies to pretty well most of the Mahayana traditions, is that we tend to use these commentaries from the great Indian masters when we want to approach a particular topic, emptiness or bodhicitta or whatever it is. In that way.
So can we trace the origin of, because we know the origin of the Pali Sutras, can we trace the origin of...
Well, when you say you know the origin of the Pali Sutras, what do you mean by that?
Because there was the council which formalized it.
Yes, but I mean, can we really prove that any of the Pali Sutras were actually taught by the Buddha? 100% proof? I think not. Can we? Really? So, therefore, often people get caught up in this, I want to prove to me that this is a teaching of the Buddha. And I think any sutra, we can't do that. We can't conclusively prove that this was uttered by the Buddha. 100%. I think that's not possible because nothing was written down at the time of the Buddha. It was only later. So I think if that is our approach, we're going to get stuck. And even if we could somehow conclusively prove that this is a teaching of the Buddha, then we need to follow the Buddha's advice anyway, and that is not to accept this merely out of devotion, but to investigate and see whether it's something meaningful and beneficial. So, you know, I think that we should rather have this approach, is to look at these various teachings and see whether they are something that makes sense and something that can benefit us. Because again, if we really demand that before I'm going to follow this, I want to know for sure that the Buddha taught this, I think we're not going to get, we're not going to be able to do anything. And of course, also the other thing we need to remember is that certainly within the Mahayana tradition, there have been many great masters who have achieved enlightenment, the same state as Shakyamuni Buddha. So why would their teachings be any less valid than the Shakyamuni Buddha? So that's the other thing. But again, the bottom line is, even if we can somehow prove that this text was written by an enlightened being, that's okay. But I mean, the thing is, we need to still check it out and see whether it's something that we can use and benefit from. So I think this is sort of a good approach. Otherwise, we get into this sort of arguments, you know, Mahayana versus Theravada, and then, of course, it doesn't really help. And actually, you know, when we look at what one of the characteristics or qualities of being a qualified student of Buddhism is, to not have this biased attitude, to not disparage other traditions, even within Buddhism. So I think this is not going to help. So that's sort of what I generally recommend. Okay, any other questions before we move on?
Home is empty, but the word empty occurs once, emptiness occurs thrice in the portal quantity. So why does form is emptiness?
Yeah. I think that, again, because if we see, the thing is, if it says form is emptiness, then it sort of says, it seems to say that form and emptiness are the same thing. But as we're going to see in the last two statements, that's not right. That's not the case. Right. So again, you have to interpret what that means. And I think that I'm only postulating now, is that form is empty. It's said that to sort of then get us to think, well, empty of what? And then once we understand that, then we understand that form is not emptiness. So then we can say emptiness is form and not come to that wrong understanding. You know what I mean? So if we look at form is empty, then we'd have to say, well, empty of what? And then we'd say empty of independent existence. Therefore, we wouldn't come to, if it said form is emptiness, you know, if we say A is B, then they're the same thing, aren't they? So then we could come to the idea, oh, form and emptiness, they're the same thing. But they're not. So by saying form is empty, that helps to avoid that. And so then by understanding that form and emptiness are not the same thing, in the first statement, then it's okay to say emptiness is form in the second, because we understand that it doesn't mean then they're the same thing, because we understood that from the first sentence. Yeah, maybe it will, yeah. I mean, I think the answer to your question probably will come in when I'm going to talk about emptiness is not other than form, form is also not other than emptiness. I think the answer is going to come there, hopefully. Let's see. Anything else? Otherwise, we'll move on to that second statement. Okay, so let's go to that second statement. So remember, these four statements are called... I call this fourfold profundity. And the first is the first profundity, and remember the word profundity, profound, is talking about emptiness. So when we talk about the two aspects of the path, the wisdom and compassion, or the wisdom and method, then the wisdom side is often called the profound path, and the method or compassion side is often called the vast path. vast as in vast activities, and profound as in deep understanding. So this is talking about four statements about this emptiness or nature of reality. The first is profundity of the ultimate, meaning the ultimate nature of things. And here this is form is empty. And of course, form is empty means empty of inherent existence. So the ultimate nature of form, or in fact all phenomena as we're going to see, is that everything is empty of inherent existence. Nothing exists independently. Now, as we're going to see shortly, is for us now there are two possibilities. Either things really have some essence, they have some substantial existence, or they don't exist at all. So often what happens is when we do this investigation and we direct, for example, at ourselves, the person, then as I mentioned yesterday, one common experience is a lot of fear coming up because we're looking for this me that seems to be here. We don't seem to find it. And this is the only me that we've identified with our entire life. And so when we're not really finding it, then we come to the conclusion, oh, this me doesn't really exist. And so we have a lot of fear because we believe or feel we're going out of existence. So what's happening there, of course, is that we're flipping to the other extreme of nihilism, which these extremes we're going to talk about shortly. So to help avoid flipping to that extreme, we have the second profundity, is the profundity of the conventional. And this is emptiness is form. Conventional, of course, means the conventional nature of things. And the statement is saying is that because of emptiness, then form can appear and arise and function. Because things are empty of independent existence, therefore, form or things in general can appear and can function. Because if things existed independently or inherently, if this was inherently a cup, if that's what its inherent nature was, to be a cup, it means it couldn't change. It couldn't become anything else. You couldn't create it, you couldn't destroy it, it couldn't actually function, it couldn't do anything, because that's its inherent nature, it couldn't change. But because that's not its inherent nature, there is no inherent nature of cup, it means therefore you can create it, you can destroy it, it can function. So that's what this statement here means, is because things are not having their own unique inherent nature, therefore, they can exist, they can arise, they can function, they can be destroyed. And this is the conventional nature of phenomena, is that in fact they are dependent. They are these what's called dependent arising. And so what we're going to do now is have a look at what do we mean by dependent arising? Because that's going to help us to understand emptiness. But before we begin that, one short presentation I want to give is that these two ideas then bring up the topic of what's called the two truths. two truths, conventional truth and ultimate truth. Sometimes people translate this as like relative truth, but most commonly conventional truth. So conventional truth is simply all the things that exist are conventional truths. And everything that exists, as we're going to see from this statement here, exists dependently. That everything that exists is a dependent phenomena, not independent. And this, of course, in Buddhism is using the term dependent arising. Conventional and ultimate in terms of bodhicitta is another presentation. I mean, it's a little bit related in that ultimate bodhicitta. See, ultimate truth is how do all of these things exist? How does everything exist? Is everything is empty of independent existence. So ultimate truth is emptiness. Ultimate bodhicitta is a realization of ultimate truth, of emptiness. So these are the two truths as they're defined within this Prasangika system which we're following here from the Heart Sutra. So the first statement that form is empty of inherent existence, this is the ultimate. So this is ultimate truth, emptiness, that not just form, everything is empty of inherent existence. And this statement here is the conventional nature. How do all of these things conventionally exist? And as we're going to see, is that everything that exists is a dependent arising. It's a dependent phenomena. What I'd like to do now, but first we're going to have morning tea break, is briefly look at the two truths according to the other philosophical schools. What do they say about the two truths? Because they have sort of a little bit different idea. So we'll briefly look at that, and then we'll go into this explanation of dependent arising, this second statement here. But first it's time for morning tea break, so let's have a cup of tea and we'll come back in half an hour.